Very well, thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals, July 6. I'll ask the marshal to introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Frisch, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Thank you. And we are proceeding remotely via Zoom. And so we are recording the proceedings this morning. We have three oral matters on our calendar. No other type of recording is allowed. In other words, it's prohibited, but we will be, our website will show the recording for all the proceedings within 24 hours. And hopefully both counsel can see the clock somewhere in the corner of your computer screen. Is that correct? I see nods. Very good. We do ask that you keep an eye on that, as well as when you begin your comments, that you do identify yourself and who you're representing for the record. The first case is A22-1816, State of Minnesota versus Jacob Ronald Shea. And counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and then begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dane DeCray, and I represent Mr. Shea. No matter how the bologna is sliced in this case, Jacob Shea wins. If you slice it thick and hold that the community living exception to the warrant requirement is no longer good law, Jacob wins because the police failed to get a warrant before searching his bedroom. If you slice it medium and hold that the community living exception is still good law, but that it doesn't apply here, Jacob wins because the police were on notice that Jacob's residence was multiple occupancy and not single family before they searched his bedroom, making the search illegal under State v. Marsh. And even if you slice it thin and hold that the community living exception is still good law and that it applies here, Jacob nonetheless still wins because the police exceeded the scope of the warrant when they searched Jacob's personal computer found inside his bedroom. Because Jacob Shea wins, no matter how the bologna is sliced, this court should reverse the ruling of the district court. I welcome the court's questions.
What do you think is your best argument, counsel? Those three.
Our best argument, Your Honor, based on the precedent of this state, is likely the second argument, which is that the community living exception is still good law in Minnesota. But it does not apply here because the police officers were on notice before they searched Jacob's bedroom that the home was not the way they anticipated when they drew up the warrant, and therefore they should have gotten a warrant to search his bedroom. And the reason for that is State versus Marsh. I know that in the district court, State versus Lorenz is the case that sets forth the standard for the community living exception. That was a 1985 case, I believe. But State versus Marsh was a 2019 Court of Appeals case. And that dealt with the issue that we have here. The issue that we have
Mr. DeCray, before you get into State versus Marsh, I want to go back to State versus Lorenz and your first argument, because I'm having a little difficult time with the framing, the phrase community living exception. I know I've seen that various times, but I want to read this sentence from Lorenz that you're just referring to, but it's on page 286. The trouble with defendant's argument is that the multiple occupancy, and that's in quotes within Lorenz, rule does not apply when two or more people or families occupy a single residence in common, as where they share common living quarters but have separate bedrooms. And so you use the phrase exception, but it just simply, our Supreme Court simply says that the multiple occupancy building rule, which I think you're referring to as an exception from, simply doesn't apply in a single family residence. And so how do you square that? Does it really matter when and what law enforcement finds out? Because it seems like it's undisputed here factually that this was a single family residence by any measure. So how does your argument square with Lorenz? And again, I'm separating a discussion of Marsh for a moment.
Well, it's difficult to separate that discussion, Your Honor, because in Marsh, it discusses that situation in Lorenz, where the normal rule is whatever the police know at the time they draft the warrant, what the type of building is, dictates the scope of the search. And so in the Wrens, because it was a single family home, the rule that was articulated is that the police may search the entire home, including all bedrooms. But in Marsh, they encountered a different situation, a departure from the Wrens. And even in Marsh, the Court of Appeals identified the fact that there's very little law on this subject in Minnesota. And so they looked to the Supreme Court in Maryland versus Garrison, and they analogized the same situation where the police thought a search warrant was going to cover an apartment on a floor. When they got there, there was two apartments. And so what the Supreme Court said is, in that moment, whether or not the police are allowed to now search something that is different than what they believed depends on the reasonableness and the notice that the police had in that moment. That's why we believe Marsh is a departure from the Wrens. The Wrens
can you clarify that just a bit? That suggests that the Court of Appeals, by departing from the Supreme Court, really was essentially not following the Supreme Court. I guess my question to you is, do you agree that in Marsh, our court simply could have issued a non-precedential opinion, cited that line I just read to you from Lorenz, and it would have been done?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, because the factual situation was different. And so I don't think it was not adhering to Lorenz precedent. What it was saying is, we are dealing with a different situation than Lorenz. And therefore, the holding or the test that they articulate in Marsh is that the validity of the search of a rented room pursuant to a warrant authorizing the search of the entire house depends on whether officers reasonably knew or should have known that it was multiple occupancy at the time of the search. That's Marsh at 831. And so I think its discussion of multiple occupancy squares it with Lorenz. But what it's saying is Lorenz did not deal with that situation. And therefore, the Court of Appeals was allowed to make this new rule to deal with the situation that we have here, that we believe our facts succeed where the Marsh facts fail.
Just to clarify, would it be true the only difference with Marsh, and that's part of what Marsh was explaining, or our court was in Marsh, and why it became precedential, is because in Lorenz, the officers knew there's more than one person living there, but in Marsh, that was not known at the time the search warrant began, the search of the residence began. But otherwise, it was a single family, otherwise dwelling with more than one person living there, essentially.
In Marsh, Your Honor?
Well, actually in both, but you reference a change, and I'm having a hard time understanding how you get past Lorenz even to look at Marsh before we even talk about the fact that Marsh did affirm the search, notwithstanding a padlock on a door and a fridge upstairs, but otherwise the facts seem similar to our case here for your client.
I think the facts are different, Your Honor, from the standpoint of notice. And I think we put that in our brief and we spend a lot of time discussing that. The reason that we look to the indicia that are articulated in Marsh is because we want to give police more leeway in their searches of single family homes when they're not sure the exact dynamics of the living situation. And so when they don't know, and when nobody's there to tell them, they are then allowed to look for these indicia that we talk about. They talk about locks on doors. We talk about numbers by the apartments, things like that. But here, the reason we believe it's different is because we don't have to reach those indicia, because the police were on notice prior to their search that this was not the home they believed, the structure of the home they believed at the time they got the search warrant. That is the ruling of Marsh. That is the thrust of Marsh. That's why Marsh didn't simply uphold the Lorenz case without articulating these indicia. If Marsh truly was just applying Lorenz, they would say single family home, you can search the entire home. What they didn't say, what they did in fact say was no, when the officers encounter something different than they reasonably expected when they applied for the search warrant, then they have to look for these indicia to determine whether or not it's multiple occupancy. Here, we didn't reach that question because two different residents told the police, this is not a single family home like you think. There are other renters, and therefore the police knew or should have known that they did not have the same scope of permission that they thought they had when they began.
Can I shift a moment, Mr. DeCrady, to your third argument? Can you explain to me why I didn't quite follow perhaps your reply to the respondent's brief that it was beyond the scope of the judge's order, which is the basis of the Rule 26 stipulation. It seemed the judge understood the argument and analyzed the argument simply as whether the community living exception, as you call it, applies such that the warrant authorized law enforcement to go into your client's room. But you're now referencing in issue three, if I understand correctly, a subsequent issue the district court did not address, which is the search of the computer, which also seems beyond the evidence, if I understand the stipulation in any event, in the record, that there was a hard drive where the pornographic material was actually found, that your client consented to that search. So why would we get to that third issue if the district court did not, and it's not part of the stipulation?
Well, I think it depends on how broadly you read the stipulation. And in our reply brief, we talk about raising an issue and then being able to articulate or further develop that issue on appeal. And so the Rule 26 agreement that was signed with the state simply said that they could challenge the district court's ruling related to the search warrant and the suppression order. And our position is that because that broad appellate right was not waived, and that was the scope, the parties could have done a narrower Rule 26. I've seen those specifically. I've seen state Supreme Court and state appellate cases that say this is beyond the scope. It's not like we're arguing a Miranda warning here when it was not at all touched on at the district court level. We have all of our arguments are tethered in the idea that the search was illegal and that we challenged the
scope. Did you specifically challenge the search of the computer, though, in the proceedings below? I mean, was that a challenge that was specifically identified, or is your argument that, you know, that sort of fell under the general challenge to the search itself?
It was not specifically challenged, but I think it is sort of like I said in our briefing, the United States Supreme Court has said, once you identify what you are challenging, you can make different challenges on appeal. And so in this United States Supreme Court case, it was a takings issue. They applied a certain takings. I argued at the district court level. When they got to the Court of Appeals in the Supreme Court, they argued a different type of takings. And the Supreme Court said, as long as you have made your broad appellate, you've preserved your argument, you can then further develop and articulate new challenges on appeal. And even if we have not specifically gotten the issue on appeal, it still should be analyzed under a plain error ruling. We may have a harder chance of winning on the third issue, but this court has jurisdiction to look at that issue and still make a determination. And when we look at that issue, what our argument is that the state was ambiguous as to what access meant to the computer. And the only access that matters in this case is digital access. And the reason it matters is because if Jacob Shea cannot get on his brother's computer, then there's no way that he can download the material or that the computer is within the ambit of the search warrant. And our position, and I filed a Rule 128 letter yesterday, is that when there is an ambiguity in the search warrant, that should be construed against the state. Construing that against the state here would make it that because Joshua only admitted to having physical access and not digital access, the search of Jacob's computer was beyond the scope of the warrant.
Am I correct, Mr. DeCray, that the pornographic material, however, was found on an external drive?
I believe
your client consented to its search?
My understanding was that the external drive was searched and there was no more material found on that drive. My understanding was that on the original search was getting into his computer through a passcode. That's where the material was found. Subsequently, other electronics were sent to the state lab and they were searched and no further material was found. The policy argument underlying this case is how much protection we want to offer individuals who rent rooms within a home. Simply because an individual rents rooms with other individuals inside of a home should not vitiate their entire reasonable expectations of privacy. A person's bedroom is probably the most sacrosanct area that they have and one of the hallmarks of the Fourth Amendment. To simply allow that to be searched, even though it is not within the reasonable expectation of the search or the person was not part of the investigation, is against the public policy of the Fourth Amendment. We again ask this court to reverse the ruling of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal and counsel for respondent. You may identify yourself and then proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Pam Foss, and I represent the state of Minnesota and the respondent in this case. Just to start at the end where Mr. DeCray was left off regarding that third argument he made in the search of the computer, that was not challenged at the district court. It was not part of the stipulation. The search of the computer was separate, and that's why you don't see anything about it in the record. You don't see any questions about it at the hearing. You don't see any arguments from the district counsel arguing it. The defense counsel didn't talk about it. It was a search of a computer. After this computer was seized during the search warrant, the defendant consented to the detective searching his computer. And that's the hard drive, and that's where the pornography was found. It was then sent to the BCA, and no additional pornography was found. But the search of the computer was by consent of the defendant. Going back to his second argument, I think this court is right when we're talking about the Lorenz decision and what the officer knew or what the detectives knew, that this wasn't a multi-dwelling house. This was a single-family house. That's how it was described by all the testimony. That's how it's described in the warrant. When Detective Van Dyke arrived at the residence, he wasn't told there was renters. He was told that the brother lived in the basement. There was no locks on the door. I mean, this was even very factually similar to the Marsh case, but for there wasn't a padlock on the door. There was no padlocks on the door. There were no door numbers. There were no separate entrances. There were no separate mailboxes.
The parties don't really focus on this fact in their briefs, at least. But I'm just wondering if you could address what, if any, significance we should place on the fact that appellant was living with a family member, a sibling.
I think that's what falls into how Lorenz described what a normal single family dwelling is, with family living together, a family situation where family is living together. That being said, the officer even asked, if he didn't go directly into the room of Jacob Shea, he asked Joshua Shea, do you have access to the electronics in that room, which the search warrant allowed him to seize, anything that Jacob Shea had access to. When Joshua Shea told him, yes, I have access to the electronics in that room, that is when the detective seized them. There was no indication otherwise that he would have gone into that room. He probably wouldn't have, other than Joshua Shea telling him, I have access. That doesn't exceed the scope of the warrant, because the warrant specifically indicates he has the right to seize anything Joshua Shea has access to. There was no discussion when the search warrant was being executed that there was any rent being paid, any agreements. In fact, when they were securing this search warrant, the only listed person on that lived at and was responsible for that residence was Joshua Shea. When the officers arrive, they find out that Jacob Shea also lives there, his brother. That's not unusual. There was nothing to indicate that there was a multifamily dwelling as discussed in the facts and in these arguments. So similar to the Marsh case, the officer, what he knew or should have known was that this was a family dwelling and there was electronics in the room that Joshua Shea had access to. And that's how he then legally seized them. There was nothing outside the scope of the warrant. There was no illegal seizures of the computer afterwards as it was consented to by the defendant. And I would argue that's not even something that this court is allowed to address, given the fact that it wasn't raised in the stipulation. And I just believe that based on the facts of this case, it's very similar to the Marsh case and that the defendant's argument or the appellant's argument should fail.
Ms. Foss, would you agree that our court in Marsh does indicate that there, obviously factors can and do and in the right situation lead to a need for a second search warrant, even in a residential home, a single residence, otherwise externally looking single residence, because that's why all those factors are there. And so that's my first question. The second question is, wouldn't you agree that that case, at least as pointed out by Mr. DeCray, when you apply that to the information the officers here had, do indicate early on in the search that there's more than Joshua living there, that there's and his roommate, but there's others, a number of others living there. What's the point of Marsh if once you learn that, that it's not, the suggestion is you better get a separate search warrant?
I do agree that Marsh did set out those factors, and I agree that once the officer in this case arrived on the scene, he learned there was other people living in the residence, but I don't think that by the analysis and what's set through by Marsh leads to throwing out this search warrant or that he should have gone and got another search warrant. Because the factors that were outlined in Marsh, like locks on the door, separate entrances, numbers on the door, that makes it appear to be a multifamily dwelling. That's what Marsh is looking at, more like perhaps a fourplex or a house that's separated into four separate units. But in this particular case, we just have bedrooms that are all sharing a common living space, very similar to Marsh. The only thing that it really didn't have that Marsh had was a separate refrigerator and locks on the door. And the appellate court said in Marsh that even that wasn't enough to make it into something where the officer should have gone and gotten another search warrant. They upheld the search on that. So I think in this case, we even have less indications than the Marsh case that it would be classified as a multi-dwelling, It's so similar to Marsh, but for the locks on the door and the refrigerator that I think following Marsh that this search warrant stands.
So essentially, do you believe Marsh actually just reiterated Lorenz, but perhaps this issue of factors was important because unlike Lorenz, there was no information about possible other people living there till the officers arise. But if I hear what you're indicating, it's still going to have to look like a multi-dwelling building. And so there's where you're talking about a duplex that are separate entrances, numbers on the door, perhaps locks and numbers on the door, all that information. Is that, or just still basically back to Lorenz? Is that your summary of the two cases?
Yes, Your Honor. And if there aren't any other questions, I would, at that point, rest with my argument.
I see no other questions. Thank you. And that would allow Mr. DeCray 5 minutes of rebuttal. And as soon as you see the five, then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me first begin by point three. I think I'm having some difficulty articulating what we mean. And it's important because what we are challenging in question three is the scope of the warrant. It's not the search of the computer itself. We did not make that challenge at the district court, and that should not be what we are waiving. The point is that we made a challenge to the scope of the search warrant. We made a challenge to the legality of the search warrant. And what we are saying here is because the state was ambiguous as to access, that goes to the scope of the warrant. Because Joshua Shea did not have digital access to that computer, the search of that computer was beyond the terms of the warrant.
Mr. DeCray, though, but just to clarify that, and I consider the record and the sort of questions that were being presented to law enforcement, and then I think it was your client's brother testified and so forth. Scope can have many different reasons, but I didn't really see an analysis, including in the briefing, of beyond the scope in terms of a search, but beyond the scope because they weren't allowed to go into that room. Isn't there that seems a whole lot different than simply a different theory of scope as opposed to a whole different issue?
It's not whether they could go in the room, Your Honor, because under this part of the analysis, we're saying the community exception is still valid. The question is whether they can grab that computer to search it by the plain terms of the search warrant. And the search warrant says primarily owned or accessed. And in actuality, on page one of our addendum in the search warrant application, the words primarily are switched. So there's an argument that it's even more unclear. If you look at addendum page one of our brief, it says materials owned or primarily accessed by Joshua Shea. Later on, it's flipped around to say primarily owned or accessed, but this is yet another ambiguity that should be construed against the state. If primarily...
I don't understand why the state is constitutionally required to be more specific in its warrant, in the search warrant. I mean, the warrant itself allows the police to search and seize devices that are primarily owned or accessible by your Joshua Shea. So I don't understand what the constitutional requirement is that be more specific. What Minnesota law requires the warrant to be more specific than that?
The reason that it needs to be more specific is because of what the terms of the search are meaning. And the idea here is that the police are there to look for child pornography materials that have been downloaded and viewed by Joshua Shea. And so the only way that those materials could possibly be on his brother's computer is if he had digital access. If he only had physical access, he couldn't download those materials. And therefore, that computer would be useless. It would have no tethering to the warrant. The specificity needed is because...
Well, I don't necessarily think that that's true. What if the brother turns on the computer, steps away from it, and then somebody walks over and starts downloading pornography onto it because it is accessible to them? You don't have to have a password to access the computer.
The computer has a passcode at the beginning where you either need to put a four-digit number in or your fingerprint or a password.
And so what if somebody else did that? It still would be accessible.
I mean, I guess that's...
Can we just go back to my original question? Is there some Minnesota authority that would help us here with your argument?
Other than the statutory interpretation that we should read the plain meaning of words, and if they're ambiguous, they should be construed against the drafter. No, there's no cases. There's federal cases that I cited in my Rule 128 letter yesterday that talk about ambiguous warrants. I have 30 seconds. Let me be very quick. Two people told the police that it wasn't a single family home. It wasn't just Joshua, who maybe has less credibility. It was Michelle, another person who answered the door and said she was a renter. The police were on notice. That changes it from Mars. The state did not mention that. And the logic here is that if that computer could have been accessed by Joshua, then the materials found should be attributed to Joshua, not Jacob. We asked the district court, opinion is reversed.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We